Okay, welcome to the EdUp Experience Legal Podcast. I'm your host, Deborah Solmore, and today I am very excited to have with me as my guest, Michael Jaworski, who is a partner and the co-chair in the Higher Learning Practice Group at Clark Wilson, LLP, located in Vancouver, British Columbia. So welcome, Michael. It's great to have you with us.
It's great to be here, Deborah. Thank you so much for having me.
So Michael and I met a few years ago when in my general counsel role, I was looking to find somebody to help advise my clients about entry into the Canadian higher education market. And we spoke a few times and ultimately end up working together, but then met in person a few weeks ago, actually in Chicago at the NACUA conference. So it's great how you make connections. And then a couple of years later, there you are standing in front of me at the end of my panel, coming to meet me in person. So that was really wonderful. I'm glad we got to reconnect.
Me too. It's and I'd say it's fantastic to be on a podcast focused on legal issues to do with the post-secondary sector. The reason I go to NACUA as a Canadian lawyer is to essentially learn how American lawyers do it, because your organization is extraordinarily well done. The program is amazing, and you have the opportunity to think deeply about so many topics that us up here in Canada, we don't get as many opportunities to explore in the depth. So NACUA was fantastic. Speaking with you about coming into the Canadian market was also fantastic. But also this podcast, we may have to take this idea and create a Canadian version.
Oh, well, I would love to appear as a guest on your Canadian podcast. So today we're actually going to focus on having you educate me and our listeners about the Canadian higher education ecosystem. I don't know if I shared this with you, but I would consider myself sort of a Canada geek. When I was growing up, two things. When I was growing up, I was a huge hockey fan. And so I used to always wish that I lived in Canada because I was always fascinated by all the Canadian hockey teams. And then when I went to undergrad, I took a Canadian politics course, and I was always fascinated by the fact that back then, when I was in college, 90% of the Canadian population lived within 100 miles of the US border and knew so much about, Americans, whereas we didn't really seem to know enough about Canadians. So I was always fascinated by that. So I'm just thrilled to have you here to talk about Canada.
Great. I'm very pleased to be here to I think expand upon the knowledge that you already have. I think that stereotype, I've heard that as well about Americans not knowing much about Canada, but I've not met many Americans that didn't know quite a bit.
Oh,
So
well, I'm glad we are making ourselves proud. So here in the US, when we think about sort of international education and our American institutions wanting to, reach out into the international market, I kind of would put that in three buckets. I would say, we have institutions that are looking to have international students take their online courses. We have in-country programs where we have international students coming to the US to study. And then I would say the third bucket, which I think is what I'd love to talk to you about, is when American institutions are thinking about expanding their physical presence, maybe brick and mortar presence in other countries. And I think that we generally think Canada is, an easy place to go. And maybe it's our, I don't know, maybe it's our Americanism. Oh, it's close. We speak the same language for the most part, most of Canada. And our higher education systems are similar, which we'll talk about. Maybe that's not the case. But so I think, people might think, well, Canada is a natural sort of thought process to think of expanding to. Would you say that that's accurate or?
Well, on the third bucket, it is we have a lot of similarities with the United States, but there are some very specific aspects of the ecosystem here that make it require some additional thought and careful consideration. The big one is, well, there's several kind of big blocks of considerations. One is that our domestic education system on the undergrad side is heavily dominated by these big public institutions. The public institutions provide a relatively low-cost education to domestic students, and that's domestic across the country, so you're not just province by province. So you know, any domestic student can go to any university across the country and pay the domestic tuition. And all of the domestic institutions, the big public institutions, are really, really highly regarded. So you can go and get a very marketable degree from any of the public institutions, whether, you know, the big ones like the University of Toronto, the University of British Columbia, or the, some of the smaller ones. They're all, you know, amongst the employment community, they're all highly regarded. So as a domestic student, that's a very compelling, return on investment. Stay local, stay in your country, and get a marketable degree. We all attract international students. That's a big draw. And so those kind of people I've spoken to who look at Canada think, well, you attract so many great international students. We want to come in and, you know, maybe tap into the international market as well as the domestic market. But the big kind of issue with domestic students that doesn't apply to international students is the international students are coming in not so much to be educated and then go back to their home jurisdictions. We have, as a country, taken international students as essentially one of the main pathways for new immigrants to come and stay in the country. And so as an international student coming into the country, the big reason you come to Canada is that after you graduate from a Canadian institution, from an accredited and recognized institution that's on the designated list held by Citizenship and Immigration Canada, you can get what's called a postgraduate work permit, which allows you to stay in the country for a couple of years working. And that all counts toward your permanent residence application. So at the end of that process, at the end of your degree and working for a couple of years, you have a very good chance of becoming a Canadian citizen. And so all of the domestic institutions can provide those, provide eligible degrees that lead to that postgraduate work permit. But that's something you have to apply for. Not everyone gets that as a matter of course. It's a matter of applying, going through the citizenship and immigration process. And so that's something that you're also competing against. You're competing, you know, any entrant into the Canadian market, has to not just get accredited in the normal way, get themselves established, but also work their way through that process so that you can compete for the international students as well. So those are kind of two big considerations when coming into Canada.
Are the international students looking to attend the big publics as the big Canadian publics as well, or is their market centered on more of the, I guess, smaller schools or, you know, private schools?
There's a mix. I'd say there is a international student market on the graduate side. So all the graduate programs, that's much more diverse. And there's lots of smaller players or international players in the Canadian market who are offering graduate programs. On the undergrad level, it does seem to be focused primarily on the big public institutions. And one thing to also appreciate is that the domestic public institutions have developed very good pathways to one another. So you can start at one and then transfer relatively easy to another. And so if many students, you know, want the brand, want to have that big, the Canadian version of Ivy League, we don't have the same concept, but if you wanted to have, you know, the University of Toronto or the University of British Columbia, you don't necessarily have to start at the University of Toronto or British Columbia. You can get there after one or two years at a smaller institution. So the pathways within within our post-secondary sector are so developed that unless you have an extraordinarily strong brand in the international market, you'd be coming in to compete against some pretty heavy hitters.
So the attraction for an American institution would be more on capturing the Canadian international market than the Canadian domestic students.
Yeah, I'd say so. Now, the exception to that would be if there's highly specialized graduate programming, especially graduate programming geared toward, you know, very job ready skills, you know, so that the programs geared toward, you know, that have highly integrated, you know, work integrated, you know, IT, for example, is a big one, especially in BC, those sorts of graduate programs that are essentially putting you in a very good position on the employment chain. Those are very strong and competitive on the domestic side. But that's, again, at that graduate level rather than the undergrad level.
Let's talk a little bit about the differences in how higher education is regulated in Canada versus the United States. So here in the United States, I explain it to people as sort of what I call the regulatory triad. So we have the Department of Education at the federal level, then we have our accreditors, who are authorized by the Department of Education to, you know, review and accredit institutions. And then we also have state regulators, and that varies, you know, by state. Some are very active, some not so active, but these are sort of the three levels, or the, you know, sort of the three parts of the triad that every institution has to be thinking about when they think about doing almost anything. And, you know, one of the things I was surprised in the short time that we conversed a few years ago was that it's a little bit different in Canada. You don't have as much, I would say, as a federal presence. Is that accurate?
Yes, that's exactly right. We wouldn't have a triad. We have just the two. We have the state, or what we call provinces, and we have our regulators, our accreditors. And so as a result, there's not as much consistency between the provinces because there is no kind of central board of education or a central department of education issuing, you know, policies that apply to everyone. So, you know, Ontario has, you know, is our biggest province by population. And it has, you know, a very different regulatory regime than British Columbia, where I live. So we look to one another. I think there's some, you know, benchmarks set between the provinces at a political level, at a staff level, but every institution has to be reviewed from a provincial standpoint. So if you're dealing with an institution and from one part of the country, and then, you know, a few weeks later dealing with somebody from another part of the country, the regulations could entirely be different. And, you know, we're all speaking the same language. There's lots of consistency between our laws and our regulations. But you know, as we all know, as lawyers, the devil or the angel, depending on how you're approaching it, is always in those details. And so, without that regulatory presence at the federal level, we do have you know, some of our provinces, you know, like many of the states, taking more of a hands-on approach, and other provinces taking a more hands-off approach. So yeah, it doesn't, we don't have that unifying presence. So the end result is that we have a bit more diversity in approach. Where we do have commonality is on research funding. So the, you know, operating grants and main regulations and our statutes are provincial, but most of our research funding comes from the federal agencies that are set up to fund research. So our provincial governments do provide a bit of, you know, ad hoc research here or there, research funding, but our main grants for most institutions come from a federal group. It's a consortium called the Tri-Council. And so the Tri-Council, they, you know, most of the research funds flow through them. And so as a result, they have a lot of power to set certain requirements and for eligibility. So if you're doing research funding, there is this, you know, the specter of a federal agency hanging over the research project. So that's the one kind of one small place in which the federal government gets their way. But I have to say they are quite limited in what they require. Unlike I've heard stories at NACUA and everywhere else that, you know, various government agencies can impose quite rigorous institution-wide requirements, you know, by holding the research funds as collateral, as it were. our tri-council and other federal agencies do not tend to get that granular. You know, there are some eligibility requirements for research funding. You know, they all want to make sure that the research policies are in place and conflict of interest policies are in place. You know, proper accounting procedures are in place, but they're not getting into the mechanics of how education is delivered or imposing requirements on everything from export controls to discrimination issues. They're a bit more hands off. They allow the general laws that apply in the state and in the province, in our case, to govern those things, and they're just focused in more on things that are relevant to research.
Do you find in your practice, because there's disparity amongst the provinces, that, and I know you spent, you know, a significant portion, about 6 years of your career practicing at the University of British Columbia, an in-house lawyer as well. We can have an offline podcast about going back to private practice versus working in-house, because I'm always fascinated about that. But do you find that your practice is centered mostly on assisting institutions in British Columbia, or do you have sort of a national practice because it's enough consistency through the higher ed differences that you can practice nationally?
Right. So we operate, I'd say, primarily in British Columbia. We've developed a few areas of expertise that are that translate to different provinces. And there are a few statutes that apply that are at the federal level. So our intellectual property laws, for example, are federal. So, you know, whether we're dealing with copyright or patent application in the research context, that goes across the country. So all those laws are essentially the same. When it comes to certain things like we call them P3s, or, you know, public-private partnerships in real estate development, the specifics of the laws are you know, in the provincial jurisdiction, but the guiding principles are in our tax code. Our Canadian tax code, and that's across the country. And so we have a national practice dealing with private public partnerships that are in that context. Charities is also another area of law that's national. So dealing with fundraising matters can be done at the federal level, and we have a practice that goes across the country for those matters. And everything else, you know, to the extent that we work with institutions at other provinces, it's because our laws are just so similar. We're really, really collegial in that way across our provinces, that ultimately the laws of British Columbia are similar enough that we can at least advise, not provide full-on legal advice, but we can advise generally on matters that are subject to the laws of another province, as long as we have another lawyer who is called in that province to go that last mile, as it were.
So sort of in summing up, if you are at an American institution now thinking you want to sort of make the move into Canada, or you want to consider it, what would you say are the top three issues that should be either as a lawyer or as a president of an institution, or as someone in leadership in a president's cabinet, thinking about, you know, these are really the things I should be thinking about before I make that decision to really dive into whether we should have a presence in Canada?
Great question. I think the biggest one is understanding that ecosystem and seeing who are the students you're going to be attracting, and who are your competitors in this market. It's all public information about which institutions are playing in which province. And so you can kind of see which provinces seem to be more open to it than others. We are I would say we're not an overly political kind of place, in the sense that there isn't a lot of massive social engineering happening. I think our regulators are more responsive and reactive to opportunities as they come up. So as institutions come forward, they present their business cases. You won't be greeted with a kind of knee-jerk reaction to say, no internationals here, please. But knowing which market you're going into, know whether you're going primarily on a graduate stream or an undergraduate stream, and understanding that larger mix and that international immigration piece, which is so unique, and how can you play into essentially every province has, you know, various goals about immigration, and also, you know, their job, their getting their career oriented population transition to the new economy. Every province is talking about that. So how can you sort of fill a niche that isn't being filled right now with our public institutions? And as you can imagine, public institutions are hard to move, like any good ocean liner. They take a while to adjust. And so I think there's really important opportunities to identify gaps in the educational market and fill those in a more timely way. So that is number one. It's just understanding what context you're in. To your point about Montreal, I think we had mentioned earlier about Quebec. Quebec is a unique
offline area, right? About talking.
The rest of the country is on the common law system. Quebec is on a civil law system. It's a unique element, and there is a major cultural difference. They hold strong to their French roots, their French history. And so that is just as fantastic as Montreal is, and it is a great place. It adds another layer of complications. So that's just a market where there's a lot of opportunity, but you have to be very attuned to the larger market. And in terms of competing for talent, one thing we haven't yet addressed is that we are a highly unionized sector. Most institutions have faculty unions, one or several at different levels. And so competing for talent here will require, at least acknowledging that you're going to be out there in the market competing with unionized employers who obviously provide benefits and other things that have been collectively bargained. And then maybe one last thing would be research funding. So to get those Canadian research funds, if you're coming into the market and again attracting top talent in the faculty ranks who want to do research, your institution needs to be eligible for Tri-Council funding. And Tri-Council funding is, as of right now, last I checked, it is highly restricted to Canadian institutions. And so again, attracting talent, it may just be a matter of attracting talent that has great partnerships with other institutions. They can be essentially joint PIs on applications. But it is a significant issue for talent retention in Canada if you can't offer essentially a stream to the main funding source in the country.
Those are great pieces of advice. I sort of see sort of the onion peeling back the layers. Oh, I want to go to Canada, but then there's this problem or this question or this issue, which is where I think it's really great to have that sort of insight before you sort of dive in to these decisions. Well, thank you. This has just been fascinating. I'm very glad that we got to connect again, and I'm really glad that we were able to record this podcast. I know you're working on a piece about things that administrators and faculty should be thinking about when they come into Canada, and I'm hoping that it will be finished in time for me to share with our audience. So I thank you. This has just been fabulous.
Very much, Deborah. Yes, the piece will hopefully go out in a publication called University Affairs, and that's a publication I'd recommend to anybody who's looking at Canada and the Canadian market. It's published by an organization called Universities Canada, which is a large umbrella organization. Every major public institution in the country is a member of it, and this is a magazine that covers all sorts of academic as well as practical administrative matters. So highly recommend it to your viewers, whether or not my piece is a part of it or not.
All right. Well, I will put a link to that in our show notes. And again, thank you very much. And I hope that we will run into each other online or in person again very soon.
I look forward to it. Thank you very much, Deborah.